welcome to another episode of the Create Magic Podcast. This is an extra special one in which I got to sit down with some really good friends and talk about the topic of mental health and the paranormal. And I couldn't think of a better group of people and fellow weirdos to discuss this with. Thank you so much to Jason from the Esoteric Book Club for setting this up. And the whole thing kind of bubbled up organically from a private group chat that we're all in, and these type of topics kind of come up and we're all bouncing around ideas, and we decided to get together and try and record something about it. And without someone like Jason to organize and coordinate everybody's schedule, it never would have happened. So thank you, Jason. And yeah, I look forward to sharing this whole episode with you. It's me, Barbara Fisher from the Six Degrees of John Keel, our good friend and druid Dasos, and Jason from the Esoteric Book Club podcast. And we all tell a little bit of our stories and just kind of talk about where the weird and the paranormal fits inside our own mental health and how we see it kind of reflecting within society and culture and a bunch of other stuff. I am going to put a brief content warning here because we do talk about suicide and some other pretty heavy topics. So if that's something that you're not comfortable with, go ahead and skip this episode. And without further ado, let's jump into the conversation here. I hope you all have a lovely weekend, and thank you for checking this out. Take care. Bye.
The 6 Degrees of John Keel podcast, Barbara Fisher, of the Creative Weirdos podcast, Todd Purse, and my new buddy, Druid Dasos Crowsong. And I am your bearded weirdo, Jason from the Esoteric Book Club. So tonight, we basically are going to have a topic discussion, a roundtable discussion about something we were talking about in our private chats. And that is mental health in the paranormal field. And we all have noticed that in some way our mental health has impacted how we interact with this whole phenomena. Would anybody like to jump in?
As far as mental health and the paranormal and my interaction with it all, it definitely was a big point. To step back, I have lots of anxiety problems and stuff. And the way I got back into weird stuff, besides the kind of classic story of finding things through the library and weird TV shows growing up, but I got back into it because I was about to have kids. I was about to have my first kid, and I got real big waves of anxiety going on and just big issues sitting with that, you know, all the unknowns of becoming a dad or a parent for the first time. And I slowly started finding myself getting back into some of the, I guess, more spiritual or esoteric teachings that I was really into via like Ram Dass and Terence McKenna. And that all slowly slipped back into the paranormal. And I realized that I was kind of searching for something to help me sit more comfortably in that big mystery, in that big like unknown, and the paranormal kind of was a fun way to enter that and kind of took the edge off of it a little bit. So I kind of got back into it through handling anxiety about a ginormous life change of becoming a parent.
Yeah, I imagine that would be kind of stress inducing, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And I didn't really have that framing for it. Like, I didn't know why I was going back to those paths until much later. It was probably like 3 years after I had a kid and I had become part of this community and gotten way more involved besides just listening and consuming the stuff, but becoming more of an active, I guess, member of the weirdo community. And that's when I was like, oh, I was just trying to figure out how to handle these like giant life questions and kind of get a grasp on how to sit in these big unknowns. And that it was all retrospective. Like, I feel like I didn't have any clue what I was fumbling towards when it was happening, if that makes sense.
Now, in hindsight, knowing why you started looking back into it, does that seem to help you going forward?
Yeah, totally. Because I think that it allowed me to realize that it doesn't matter where the helpful stuff comes from. Like, a lot of the times people will shy away from taking routes that might be very helpful or beneficial for them because it doesn't come from an official channel, like a therapist or somebody that's, or a more trusted personal connection, like a friend or a family member. It came from Terrence McKenna, this weirdo talking about mushrooms and these crazy trips and this communication and how the imagination is the most important thing. And it went from that to me being like, oh, he's also talking about aliens all the time, and getting into John Keel, and then being like, oh yeah, Robert Anton Wilson, and starting reading Robert Anton and all these things, where it's like you can pull these little, I guess, nuggets from a lot of places that people wouldn't think you would find those kind of anxiety reducing things. And it might not be that way for everybody. That's the other thing that I think is really important, is that I found my way there, and it's helped me a lot with kind of continuing that management of living in the unknown. But I mean, it definitely wouldn't work that way for everybody, I feel like.
Barbara?
I have sort of a PTSD is what it's officially called, from growing up in an unsafe household. We'll put it that way. Both of my parents were alcoholics in various functional states of alcoholicdom. You know, I mean, it's not like the house caught fire and nobody noticed or anything like that. But I was pretty consistently put into unsafe situations. And I basically went from that to marrying my high school sweetheart, who was also an alcoholic and had mental illness problems. My mom had lots of mental illness problems. It was kind of telling, though, that his were seen as less bad than my mother's. So, you know, I just married him because he seemed like a more normal person. I found out later that that wasn't the case, but I do have issues with some PTSD triggers. Not great with violence, not great with, you know, feeling like I'm being followed or stalked or anything like that, because that has happened and it's really crappy. So I learned as a kid how to dissociate my mind from my body, just kind of like putting it over to the left a little bit. Actually, that's my right hand, isn't it? Yeah, to the left. I have left-right dyslexia too. But just putting my consciousness over there. And that is a coping mechanism. Just like PTSD really is a coping mechanism, it isn't really a mental illness. It is a coping mechanism or a survival mechanism that becomes dysfunctional. So dissociation is the same thing. But what I found was when I disconnected from my body, there was all of these other things that I started noticing. And that's when I started, you know, seeing things. And I was young enough that I didn't have any concept of what a hallucination would be. Besides, it interacted with me and my cat could see them. I could see the cat interact with those things. So I was pretty sure that that was just some other part of reality. So one could say that my mental health has definitely pushed me toward, quote unquote, the paranormal, although I'm pretty sure it's actually normal. But not everybody can disconnect that easily and walk right into it. So I don't know. I hear so many stories from people that have seen and experienced things that I'm like, this is pretty normal. So, and I actually, when I started my podcast, I came out to my therapist as being, you know, a weirdo. And she was like, well, I kind of had a feeling, you know, I looked at your art. And so are you painting and drawing things that you see? And I went, yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I said, so am I crazy? You know, because I'm going to start this podcast and I don't want to, like, you know, be spreading crazy stuff to people and harming them. She goes, no, I actually think you're pretty normal. So start that podcast with my blessing. So that's kind of my sort of entry into this. Is it normal? Is it paranormal? Is it mental health? Is it something else?
So do you see these things all the time, or is it something that you consciously have to shift your focus in order to see them?
It depends. If they want to be seen, sometimes it doesn't matter what I want to do. I will see them. Sometimes it just happens. Like the other night, I got up to go to the bathroom and I sat down and looked over and there was something behind the door that was sort of coalescing into a face. And I was like, really, guy? Really? While I'm in here? What? No, that's not appropriate. Go, go. And it sort of crept backwards into the gloom behind the door. I was just like, what? But it wasn't a thing that I was afraid of. It didn't have that vibe. So I just was kind of like, oh, whatever, rude guy, and went back to bed. Sometimes, yeah, I have to work to see things. Sometimes it starts and I'm like, oh, this is going to be a migraine because I'll get, the sparkles. But sometimes it's not a migraine, or it's what's called the aura without the migraine. But sometimes it coalesces into things. And then there are the times that I'm with someone else and they see it too. And I just go, okay. Guess we're both seeing it. All right. That's all right then. So no, it's not every day. I'd have a hell of a time getting a job if it was. I don't want to hire her. She sees crap.
She's staring off into the corner talking to something that's not there.
Yeah. I mean, but yeah, some of the most solid things I saw was while I was working at a job. And I was, well, why is there a little guy there? Okay, I'm going to take the trash out. I don't know what that is, but not playing with it.
Dazos, you're up.
So my journey to the paranormal has been a pretty interesting one because my path into druidry sort of came out of my sobriety experience and trying to... Actually, let me back up a bit. My background is I have PTSD, largely from religious trauma and abuse that went on through early childhood into late teens, and really a structure I didn't get out of until my mid-20s. And so that led me through an experience with addiction and then recovery, and then really trying to rebuild some sort of spiritual path for myself. I had a lot of difficulty with that initially because I had a lot of anxiety. I felt stupid a lot about, just believing in anything for a while. Aaron Deese is my best friend, and he and I were talking, and I told him about getting into druidry and everything, and he told me about this group that he had recently been hanging out with on an app called Clubhouse, and it's CryptoCasters was the room on Clubhouse that he invited me to. And it was really neat because they were just I think it was Thursdays at the time that everybody was getting together, and people would just get on and share whatever stories they had heard recently in the news, or sometimes people who had their own experiences would come on and talk. For a while, it's really good that I wasn't on a mic or anything, because I'm sitting listening to these stories and kind of dying of secondhand embarrassment on behalf of the person speaking. And, it's really good that nobody could hear my reactions to these things, because nobody else was reacting the way I was, because it was a safe space for people to come with their weird stories about the light that they saw while they were checking the mail or whatever, and be heard, and just have a bunch of people go, wow, that's intense. How did that make you feel? And, you know, when you get through all of the woo or the crypto or the meta or the para, it's stories. It's a bunch of people telling stories and hearing stories and just kind of like creating a space for that to happen. And watching that unfold every week really kind of gave me an ability to engage with the spiritual experiences that I was having a bit more. It kind of allowed me to allow myself to have those experiences.
That's awesome. Hey, do you mind if I jump in real quick, Jason, and ask a question? Yeah, so you brought up the path of recovery, and I was just talking to my brother who went through a similar thing, and he I think he's 5 years clean now and went through AA, and we were talking about the importance of that finding the higher power, and it got me thinking about how the paranormal is a way that like you can kind of relate to that higher power without some of those context words. And it made me think of my friend, like, or some of those words that have weird contexts, like God and religion and things like that. Right. And I was talking to my buddy who also went through recovery, but couldn't click with the AA for a long time because of the giving it up to a higher power type thing. He had a lot of trouble with that. And what got him past that point was actually the Temptations made for a TV movie that was on VH1 back in the 90s, early 2000s. Are you familiar with this at all, anybody? I loved these movies. These Temptations were one of my favorite, you know, soul acts, and all those VH1 movies were just so cheesy and amazing. But there's this one part where Blue, who's one of the main Temptations, he's at a doctor's office, and the doctor's telling him he's never going to dance again. He has to stop touring. He can't do this anymore. He's destroying himself physically. And Blue looks at the doctor and just says, "Have you ever felt what it feels like to be a part of something bigger than yourself?" And that was what did it for my dude. Like, that was the moment where he was like, "Oh, Otis Redding can be my higher power. Like, the Temptations, like Chuck Berry, the Ramones, like rock and roll can be the thing. It doesn't have to be a religious structure." And I think the paranormal can play that same role for people that might have some weird hangups about religions or religious trauma and things like that.
Absolutely.
The only pushback I would have against that is that it is also very likely for that to turn into conspiracy, especially at that stage in recovery. You know, ultimately there's always stuff to look out for, so that's just
sure. Yeah, I mean, hey, Otis Redding and Chuck Berry probably aren't the best moral compasses either, as far as I've luckily did not get bit with that bug and have not been through it myself, but totally think there's plenty to be cautious about that. That's a great point, Jason.
Well, I guess that means it's my turn. So I've always just been a weirdo my entire life. But for a long time, I really just put down spirituality and paranormal and all of that. I put it aside and I tried to live like a normal ass person. It was miserable. And then in 2016, when I felt like I was at the height of happiness, like everything was going right for me, the girl that I was seeing at the time took her own life. And that just threw me in a complete downward spiral. And then less than a year later, I got laid off from my job out of nowhere. I was completely blindsided by this, which means I also had no access to healthcare, which at the time was providing me with medication for PTSD. But when I got laid off, I realized something very important. And that was that I didn't care. Because the medication I was taking had so completely numbed my emotions that being laid off from a job that I expected to work at until I retired didn't affect me at all. So from that point on, I started to try to re-examine and regain some sort of footing on a spiritual path. And at the time, I remember that I really hadn't found anything that worked for me. The closest thing I had found was some of the Taoist philosophies, but a lot of their practical methods I didn't necessarily want to follow. But it was the animism that really stuck with me. And that's when I started to discover Druidry. And I discovered that Druidry is about as varied a practice as you can get. I was actually talking to Dazos about this. There's one branch that focuses more on magic. There's one that focuses on research and one that focuses on philosophy or service or things like that. You know, it was leadership. So I started to kind of just use that as a template to form basically my own belief system following a Druid framework and Druid philosophy. So that is really what brought me back into, for the lack of a better term, into the regular everyday world. And it led me to becoming ordained, which is actually something I did to honor my late girlfriend, because one of her big struggles was with being bisexual. And I don't want to go too much more into that because it's not my story to tell. But it was something she and I had discussed, and that I wanted to make things easier for people like her and people in that community to get married. And it's something I was willing to do. So I just went ahead and got ordained and started performing marriage ceremonies. So I'm not really sure where I'm going with that, but that is, it's just, it's a big step that I took in healing from the PTSD that I was dealing with from that whole situation.
Wow. That's really tough, Jason. That's impressive that you could even take that step. I mean, that's really tough story, but I'm glad that you found your way there. And how long did it take for you to become ordained? How big of a process is that?
It is shockingly fast. I went online to the Universal Life Church. I filled out the paperwork. The longest thing was to have it mailed to me.
Yes. Okay. I have heard of that one. That makes sense.
Yeah. I got ordained through there, and then I got certified through the state. And that took just as long as whatever it takes the mail to go from one place to another.
Yeah. Works the same way in Ohio.
Yeah, that's when I found out, like, West Virginia is pretty nice because you can be certified by the state and not have to worry about county to county basis. Pennsylvania, on the other hand, it's by county.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the one county I did perform a wedding in, I got real lucky. They were just like, oh, are you nationally certified? Yeah, then you're fine. Didn't have to do anything extra for that. Now you see why I asked you about trigger warnings before we even started recording.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it seems like three out of the four of us are dealing with PTSD in some form.
I always feel funny saying that to like someone from the general public, because a lot of people think that, well, then you were in the army, you know, you served in Iraq. And I'm like, no, I did not. And they're like, well, and I'm like, okay, so it doesn't have to be war that does it. Whatever it is, it just has to be sufficiently traumatic that your brain decides to go into overdrive and your adrenal system goes into overdrive and is then going to protect you forever and ever by making you anxious and wanting to run away from everything and giving you night terrors and all of these things. I'm like, you know, PTSD, when you see it in media, is almost always a wartime thing. Like, and I think veterans are a very distinct branch of our PTSD family, and the way that they react and the things that heal them are not necessarily what heals other people. But I will say I've never had an ex-soldier say to me that I didn't have PTSD because I wasn't a soldier. They're like, oh, yeah, no. You can have it for other reasons. And hey, you can go to war and already have it.
Yeah.
And that's a really sad case. And that's a really messed up case.
I feel like our society may be a bit more accepting of military service based PTSD because it's something that is more publicized. It's more in the limelight. Mm-hmm. It's something people understand. But if you say, no, it's PTSD from, say, like a single event or from long-term abuse,
mm-hmm.
that's more nebulous. So yeah. It's like, especially if you're not able and willing to talk about what caused it.
Yes. Yes.
The expansion of those terms, I feel like is really fascinating and useful because forever they didn't even have PTSD to describe what happened in war or like, you know, that was a relatively modern term for that. Right. Like that was not my, I guess, like
we had like shell shock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Totally. So like, yeah, the way those terms become a little bit more, I guess, positive, for lack of a better word, like, you know, post-traumatic stress, PTSD is way more of an acceptable term than shell-shocked, or it's going to do better things for you mentally. You know, it's going to sound a little bit more, I guess, I don't want to say legitimate, but it has an air of something that is almost medical that can be addressed. Mm-hmm. And like the way we name these things, I think, is really important. And the progression of the way we name these things, I came up with a lot more experience with learning disabilities than anything else as far as official diagnoses. And the way that they diagnose and name learning disabilities has even changed a lot from, mm-hmm. you know, my kids now. They stopped using a lot of the words like disorder or defect and things like that. And I think that goes a long way with the way we talk mm-hmm. to ourselves and everything. And I don't know. It's interesting to me to think about all of those people that were dealing with PTSD and didn't have a name for it and what that next iteration of it's going to be, like how it's going, those terms are going to keep expanding. And like, it makes me think about the idea of like, you know, generational trauma that gets passed down and how much more legitimate that's being looked at now and how it's being scientifically backed up. So like PTSD might not even be from a lifetime that we've lived. It could be from, you know, generations mm-hmm. ago in certain ways. So the more these terms get bigger and more open, I feel like the more people can fall into them and find the usefulness that they provide.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That's part of why when I talk with people about PTSD, yes, post-traumatic stress disorder is in the name, but I still, and I have this from several therapists, that really what's going on is your ability to cope with fear, anxiety, and the things that happened to you has just gone too far. Like you are no longer in the situation that harmed you, but your body and your brain don't really know that anymore. And so that's one of the things that I like to tell people. It's like, now you just basically have an overactive, you know, sense of safety. You know, your brain just really wants everything around to be safe. And of course, the world isn't that way, right?
Yeah.
But you have to bring that adrenal system into like line so that it's not reacting to everything, because everything isn't actually dangerous. So it's a process. But I think it helps if people don't feel like they're defective in some way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like even on the learning side, they don't cut, like my son has a few different paths and a few different people he works with. And some people use learning differences. And I like that mm-hmm. one the best. Some people use learning challenges. And that one still has a little bit of a negative connotation. Mm-hmm. But like, I think using those terms, and like you said, not only using those terms, but describing it the way you did, attention deficit disorders, when I use the same thing, that they don't have a attention disorder. Their attention is filtered differently. They utilize attention differently. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean it's bad. It's just disordered in context to our current society and the way that we run things. And that's a lot of, like, when we say there's these, you know, whether it's a challenge or a difference or a disorder, whatever word it is, a lot of the times it just means that the thing's not functioning in the way that the, you know, general public functions. It doesn't really, it shouldn't be looked mm-hmm. at as a negative a lot of the times. And I find the more that I've, with my podcast, got to talk to a lot of artists and stuff, it's universal almost, that, you know, creative people see the world differently. And a lot of the times at a young age, that gets labeled as a learning disorder or as a, you know, mental disorder or things like that. And it's just that they're experiencing everything a little bit different than the people that are, you know, around them. And that can really affect the way people grow up and see the world.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
This is very similar to a conversation I was having with Vuk earlier. I don't even know why he brought this up. He just messaged me and he's like, you know, learning disabilities and things that are labeled as disorders and things like that may not actually be disabilities or disorders. It's just that it's a varied way to interact with the world. And it's conflicting with this socially constructed agreement that this is the one way we're supposed to behave and interact with society.
Mm-hmm.
And that people don't all fit in within that constructed narrative that we have for our society. So they're labeled as having a disorder, when it's not a disorder, it's just how they interact.
Even when we're, you know, using prettied up language and everything, the way that we treat certain things really matters, because, you know, a lot of neurodivergent kids are put through ABA therapy. And I know that there's a lot of controversy over whether or not that's any good for them. And I'm kind of on the side of probably not, because, I mean, if you've got a kid lining up their toys in a straight line and the therapist is going, oh, you need to disrupt that behavior, why? You know, just because a kid is playing differently from what a neurotypical kid plays doesn't mean that that child needs to be brought into line. I don't care if you call it a disability or a difference or anything. Maybe just foster a way for that kid to function within that framework instead of, you know. And there's a lot of, you know, situations where we're using, you know, what sounds like more progressive speak around things, but we're still actively doing harm to neurodivergent kids, to, you know, well, even like to queer kids and other, you know, getting way off, mm-hmm. you know, into other just ways in which people don't conform, that don't really actively harm anybody or anything, but still get conditioned out. You know, one thing that I was thinking of, I was born left-handed. That was actually through physical punishment and yelling and, you know, not even good parenting by modern standards. That was conditioned out of me until I was right-handed with really poor penmanship, and I still am. But, you know, I mean, there are so many things that kids face that are just like that, that aren't even really thought of as being abusive. But, you know, would you smack an adult for writing left-handed because that displeased you? You know, I mean, if you were at the bank and the person at the window next to you was writing left-handed, who in their right mind would feel comfortable physically disciplining somebody for that? But we do it kids thousands of times over, thousands of times a day, you know?
And the reason for it is so ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, you're left-handed, that means you're evil.
Yeah, what? No, it was, I mean, in my case, when I say religious abuse, those are the kind of things that I'm talking about. You know, that mm-hmm. was equated to being of Satan.
Yeah.
The left-hand path in paganism is, you know, the satanic path, or the path of however you want to talk about it. But yeah, sinister.
Mm-hmm.
That word comes, it was a description of the left-handedness. Sinister. They were sinister. My father and his sister and his other sister were born left-handed. And his father would let them write left-handed, but they had to eat right-handed because he didn't like the elbows sticking out into other people at the table.
Oh my gosh.
So it was always weird to me when I was little and I realized there was such a thing as handedness, you know, because at first you don't really, people eat with forks. That's what you do. And my dad was eating with his right hand, but he wrote with his left hand and drew with his left hand. And I was like, and he said, oh, my dad didn't like it. Papa didn't like it. So, you know, he'd slap our hands. And so we learned not to eat that way. And I'm like, okay, that's not dysfunctional or anything. I mean, that
totally.
Sounds like they needed a bigger table.
I know, right? That was probably part of the problem is they had a small kitchen.
I think you really hit something, Dasos, when you said that people are using that more progressive language, but not leading by example or by action a lot of the times. Because as a parent, I find myself in that situation like constantly where I'm like, you know, I'm saying one thing to the kid and being like, oh, yeah, I could get better at that myself by a whole lot. And like not always making that connection that the way that you behave trumps whatever you're saying. And I think that's a really important point. But I do think even with that point made, the language does lead the rest of it. I feel like just using the language isn't enough, but it is the first step that's going to drag the rest of it forward, hopefully, if that makes sense. Like, I think that the words we use and the stories we tell ourselves are super important. So if we can start there and at least kind of craft that a little bit, then the rest of it will follow, and maybe not as fast as we would like it to, but you know, it hopefully will help it along.
Language and terms that we use are funny too, because there's sometimes where a more modern term seems to sanitize the situation. Mm-hmm. So like PTSD is great, but you know, it seems like to me stress doesn't fully encompass what's going on.
No.
And shell shock is too narrow focused.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a term that's more accepted, but it still doesn't really convey what we're trying to say. Conversely, there are more modern terms for certain things that, you know, it's just a different word. It's still being used in the same way, and it still has that negative connotation with it that doesn't really help anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm old enough to remember when kids with what were called learning disabilities at the time, and it was just a blanket term. Like, you know, everybody who didn't do everything just exactly so went over there. You know, if you were a little bit slow, you went there. If you couldn't read, you went there. If you had dyslexia, you went there. And they had their own separate classroom. And there was no way for any of the kids to learn how to treat people who had different wiring in their brain, essentially, how we were supposed to treat them. We did not learn anything that was useful. I look at it now and I'm just like, oh my God, they still used the R word. You know, they still would say that word. And you know, of course, by the time I got older, it was, I don't say that, you know, but you're still thinking it, you know, and it was still seen as kind of okay. You know, I mean, I did grow up in West Virginia. And as I said, you know, I was born in 1965 and it was still the 1950s. You know, they hadn't let go of that. Mm-hmm. You know, women were still supposed to be staying home, raising their children and looking like Donna Reed and all that. And you know, everything was just a little bit socially slower. And so, you know, there are things that I grew up seeing and my husband is just like, what? because I'm only 3 years older than him. And he's like, it sounds like you grew up in, you know, like the 1950s. And I went, well,
yeah,
did kind of. But yeah, that was terrible. That was terrible that those kids didn't get socialized with them and they didn't get socialized with us. Yeah. And so as they grew up, I'm sitting here going, what happened to those kids? Where did those kids end up? What's happening?
That's kind of a scary thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. It's sad. It's one of those things that I think time and perspective does a lot on. And it's the type of thing that, like, actually, that brings up a great question, Barbara. Like, what happened to those kids now? And what if they could go back and redo it, right, and be integrated with that class and be a part of it? Because I was in the remedial classes, and I was in the, like, I had, even in high school, I actually got really lucky in high school. They gave me, so the first couple years, I have, like, numeric dyslexia, spatial disorder, and regular dyslexia. So I kind of got a whole boatload of stuff going on with reading and learning and whatnot. And luckily, I came from the point of privilege to go to a Catholic school, go to a private school. And the way they handled it was, once I got to high school, they realized I really liked art and they just gave me a bunch of art classes. They're like, okay, you're not going to get past algebra. Like, you're going to take 2 years of algebra, and then you're going to take 2 years of what they called basic math, which was, here's how you fill out a checkbook. Here's how you balance your very practical things that really probably helped me a lot in the long run. But they gave me that. And then when it came time to hit the credits, they would give me extra, like, I ran my school's artistic and what's called literary magazine for 2 years. And then I did the yearbook design and stuff like that. So they took me out of Spanish class. They're like, don't worry about foreign language. We'll credit you that if you do the yearbook design and run that. So, like, I got very lucky in that they kind of manipulated my education around that. And I think back to the situation you were just describing and how, like, that's obviously the exact opposite of, like, they're not trying to be creative in the way to work with these people. And what does happen to those people, and how do they integrate into the rest of society after they started out in a very secluded area and, like, essentially being told that they can't do it? But it also made me think of, Jason, what you were talking about with VUCA a little bit ago, and, like, you know, essentially these things don't function because of the way society's set up. And when you backtrack that, it all comes back down to commerce and economics.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one of the things that's super interesting to me, is how economics affects mental health and mental well-being. And I think today we're not too far off from a place where everybody's going to have some sort of challenge mentally because of the way that commerce and the economy is being run. And I think that what you're describing, Barbara, was like the beginning of, not the beginning, but kind of like where a big turning point happened. And even as, like, Das Alice was saying, like, we're getting more progressive, and, like, my situation was great. They really helped me out, but it's still not fixing the underlying problem, is that we're all being pushed through a system that's supposed to end with you come out and you become a productive member of society, whatever that means. Or, you know, we're still playing the game in the big system that is causing all of these problems. I was thinking, like, half of my job, half of how I make my money is off of interacting with my phone. And, like, that is probably the worst thing for mental health right now, because essentially the part that I'm not doing drawings when I'm selling the stuff, it's all through the phone. It's all through Instagram, and, like, even to the coffee company, a big part of what I do for them is run their Instagram and run their. So, like, I am financially tied to this thing that is proven to have these, like, you know, very negative health effects. And again, it all comes back down to economics and having to. So I'm very interested in the tie between economics and mental health, and how thinking weirder can help those things. Like, how changing the narrative, like, if I sat with that narrative that I just explained, I would probably be doing way worse than I am right now. But that's not the narrative I tell myself. I tell myself I'm a full-time artist who has to dabble on the phone, but really I'm on the phone way more than I probably should be because of it. But changing that narrative in my mind helps a lot. But yeah, do you guys find that, you know, commerce is a part of what's going on with your mental challenges?
Yes.
Yeah.
resounding yes. I actually just had a conversation with another podcaster, Saba O'Kiley, who is a Southern Fried Witch, about, you know, her, the angle that we were talking about was magic and how poverty impacts magic, because both of us in our past have gone through periods of homelessness. And, you know, poverty causes mental health problems. Just, you know, anybody living in poverty is behind the curve on mental health mm-hmm. from the get-go. And not only that, but they're also behind the curve on accessing ways out of whatever issue they're in. And mm-hmm. so, you know, if you're in poverty, not only are you more likely dealing with mental illness, but you're less likely to be able to get treatment or adequate treatment or medication if you need it. That's a problem that does not seem to be getting any better anytime soon in this country. I mean, wealth inequality is growing right now.
Yeah, that mixed with our, you know, wonderful healthcare system is just perfect recipe for success.
Look at how Congress has impacted that, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So do you think that stories of the weird and paranormal, like, how can this be applied? Like, we kind of all said how we got back into it as adults. Like, do you think there is practical things within these stories and mythologies that can be applied to help people in situations where they are struggling a little bit more than the normal, or they're in a deeper, darker place? Like, to me, one of the things I always get out of these kind of rabbit holes or these different types of looking at the world is that feeling that you're really small, like the feeling that like what is going on in your life doesn't really matter as much as you think it does. And that's kind of one of the things that I take away from a lot of different stuff that I'm really into. And one of the big memories I have growing up is that like first time you see a really big open sky with all the stars and stuff and just being like, oh, this is like the tiniest I've ever felt in my life. And getting back to that feeling is really helpful to me. And stories of the strange, or whether it's like, you know, psi or ghosts or cryptids, all of those things can kind of make you feel really small in the world again. And that helps me for some reason. Is there anything that you all find that's like a practical help with these different stories or researching the stuff that you do?
I feel like the weird allows me to see from outside. So like I'm able to see society, how it's working mechanically as an outsider, but not feel like I have to actively participate while I'm observing.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
But it also, you were talking about how poverty and lack of opportunity really changes how people think and behave. It also causes people to be more prone to look for alternative solutions. And even if it's something like magic, not to say anything about it, but just in general, like let's say that magic is just spicy psychology. If you're doing a magic ritual that helps you feel like you have a better grasp on what's happening to you, that in itself should be enough to justify doing it.
Yes.
Yeah. That's actually what we were getting at is, you know, art and magic are both something that, you know, kind of give voice to the voiceless. They're things that people reach for when they're not feeling empowered and can bring a sense of feeling power over your situation, even if you don't have any. You know, it gives you something to do, even if nothing else. But it can also be a vent of that struggle.
Well, that's another connection that we all four of us have. We're all artists.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That's a great. So how has y'all's creative life helped you through these things? Because I could do a whole podcast on just like essentially how leaning into making stuff has saved me in like a million different points in my life. Has that been similar for you all?
Well, Dazos, I see you actively working on something right now.
I know. I could see him. He's got some thread happening. And
yeah. Well,
are you spinning?
Yes, I'm spinning while we're talking. It helps me focus on the conversation that we're having. And I think I noticed you kind of stimming with a rock earlier.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely doing anything with my hands, working hands-on stuff helps me concentrate. Just kind of helps me work off whatever excess anxiety I think is going on at the moment, because I'm always pretty much at a 10 with my anxiety levels.
In my case, I've always made arts and crafts. I took art and made art up until like 10th grade. And I'll just tell the truth. My mom said that I wasn't good at it at one point, which is something that none of us would say to a child, our child, anybody's child,
yeah,
or to anybody else, an adult. We just wouldn't say it because that's just not a thing you say.
No.
But she did that. And I was like, okay, fine. Art wasn't safe, you know, so I did crafts. Now I am old enough and cynical enough to go, what's the difference between an art and a craft? And the technical answer is that crafts create something that is practical and usable. It's usable art, wearable art. That's what it is. That's the difference. And my bitchy answer is men make art and women make crafts. Now, Desus is putting the lie to it right over there, spinning thread out of his fiber. But that is kind of a thing. Again, I'm older than y'all, so I've seen some ugly from the past that thankfully is not the way it is now. We have a much more kind and semi-egalitarian society. And the counterculture that is we're all a part of is fairly egalitarian. So the ugly is not as part of it was when I was a kid. But it's interesting. When I do art or craft, I don't even keep them. I don't even separate them anymore. It does calm the mind. It allows me to express inner thoughts or aesthetic feelings in a way that other people can see and understand. And so I'm also like Dasos. If I'm, you know, in the middle of a conversation with somebody, I like to be sewing something or playing with plastic clay, plasticine clay. I suck at actual earth clay. My hands aren't strong enough anymore to do that. So arthritis is like, no, girl. So I can't do real clay. So I have to do like, you know, Sculpey and that stuff. But it keeps me in the flow of the conversation. I don't get distracted. Something about the tactile sense of doing something with my hands keeps it all going in a flow. Because I go into a flow state when I do art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I can't be in a full flow state when I'm doing art and having a conversation. But I can go into a half flow state and the conversation works a lot better. Yeah. So
and
I think that's been that's what it does.
If I may, I'd like to jump in real quick and just make a point that, you know, Barbara and I both just shared things that help us focus, help us pay attention. And yet kids, neurotypical and neurodivergent, are taught that paying attention looks like sitting still, eyes on the speaker, hands in your lap, folded, feet on the floor, not moving. And that doesn't work for even many neurotypical kids. Yes. So, you know,
it's so true.
Just kind of underlines that point that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. We're super lucky to have Teddy in the only public Montessori school in the area, and seeing the difference in the way a Montessori classroom is run versus what I'm used to growing up, I was like, oh, why isn't it all right this way? This makes so much more sense.
Like, doesn't it?
There's no desks. Kids pick up their own projects. They stop working when they want. Everything's taught through their interests. So, like, my kid's super into space. So, like, all of the stuff, like whether it's math or like all of the social, cultural, it's all taught through a lens that he's interested in. And I'm like, this just makes so much more sense. It's just like, yeah. And it stinks that it's generally something that costs way more for Pete. Like, if we didn't get him into the public one, he would be in a regular school system because we can't afford. I think it was $10,000 for the kindergarten year at the regular Montessori. And I'm like, what is life? Who is these people that can send their kids to a $10,000 kindergarten? It's not me. But that's like super, because I draw notes the whole time. Mm-hmm. Like every conference I have stacks. At some point I'm going to make a zine out of the 60 some interviews that I've done, because I have stacks of sketches that I've done during all of them that won't make any sense. Like, it's just going to be gobbledygook, but there's some really fun little pictures that I love stuff like that. But I'm the same way, and I was yelled at in school all the time, stop drawing, stop doodling. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is how I do it, this is how I pay attention and how I focus. And yeah, it's one of those things that I think goes a long way. And I think that the way, whether it's used as a coping mechanism, or I use drawing a lot as a social engineering mechanism, for lack of a better word. It's like, I was the kid that would sit at the table and draw until somebody came over to me and was like, what are you drawing? And that's how I would start the conversation. Mm-hmm. That's how I would kind of like find my place in a community. Like, when I first started going to punk shows, I never played an instrument. I never cared about playing music, but I could draw. And I was like, I'll make flyers. I can do something. I can print t-shirts. And that's when I learned how to screen print and everything. Cause there's always been a way to find community through art for me, and that's always been a big part of why it's so helpful with the struggles I've had mentally and with the anxiety and especially social anxiety that I've dealt with. And I think that just having more access to creativity is really important, and we're in a really cool place as far as that goes. Like, as far as just having tools to make stuff and the access to do that and share it, I think we're in a really I think a lot of what we've talked about, there are these other sides to, or this paradoxical thing going on, right? Like, everything we just said is very true, but there could be another statement that's just as true to most of it. And I think this is one of them. But I think creativity is such an important part to kind of figuring out who you are. And not only that, but getting used to tapping into that spiritual side. And I'm spiritual as in the non-material, not the like religious spiritual, but like when you're making stuff, you're tapping into the same thing as you are when you're meditating, or when you're having all these different kind of anomalous experiences. And the more that you can kind of reach that flow state that Barbara mentioned, the more I feel like you get comfortable being in those weird states. And that really helps with my anxiety. Like, when I start feeling weird and I'm not at the drawing table, I'm like, oh, wait a second, I know what's going on here. I have a little bit more of a frame of reference for it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, we're coming up on an hour here. Do we want to go ahead and take a break and then maybe come back, record for another 30 minutes or so?
Whatever. That sounds good to me. Yeah.
So, Todd, you were talking about how you would doodle and draw in class that would help you focus, right?
Mm-hmm.
I had kind of the opposite problem. Enough so that in college, I was taking a summer class, and the professor had everyone stay in one room. He went to a neighboring room and called people in one at a time. And he said, okay, this is your final. I'm going to ask you one question. And everybody was getting questions about stuff that happened in class, right? The subject that we were working on. Well, I go in there. He looks over my notes and he looks over my grades and he says, okay, so I noticed that you don't take notes in class. Why is that? Well, if I have a pen and paper, I doodle and then I won't pay attention. Oh, so, okay. Well, that's a good answer. You pass. But yeah, no, that's been a thing growing
up. That's amazing.
Like, I have to limit what I have available to draw with, because if I get too focused on that, I don't pay attention to the lecture that's taking place. But definitely. I also I have number dyslexia too.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I was going to say, you two might be the first people in my adult life that I've met that have numeric dyslexia. It was like, I didn't know anybody growing up who had it. Like, I remember getting in trouble and them calling me into the principal's office and they're like, what's your dad's work phone number? And I'm like, I don't know. And they're like, no, you're messing. Like, I got in more trouble because they swore that I was like not giving it to them so they wouldn't call them. I'm like, no, literally, I don't know. I know, like, I know patterns. I can like show you the pattern on the keys, yeah, but I can't tell you the numbers. Like if you show me the phone, I can dial it for you, but I can't tell you what the numbers are. And that's just how my brain has always worked. But yeah.
One of the ways my parents got around that is they actually turned phone numbers into songs for us.
That's so smart.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I would have never got that. Would have been so helpful for me. That's what. Do you think there's a connection as far as the what we started talking with about as far as these different mental health challenges and learning challenges? Like, do you think the two are usually go hand in hand? Or from my experience, I feel like they support each other in my brain, in my weird brain. Like my anxiety kind of goes along with my spatial disorder and my dyslexia, if that makes sense. Like they all kind of seem to be a part of a big whole. And I don't, do you guys feel that at all? Like, do you feel a connection inside with them?
I think it's more that it's trying to, like we were saying with society, it's trying to fit a round peg in a square hole.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. That's what I think about with my math challenges, as it were.
Yeah.
I know that it's really interesting. In fourth grade, they had us do partnership work. This is like a big deal at that time. Like we had two kids teaming up doing math. And the kid that was teamed with me, he watched me and he said, she does the math right, but the numbers are switched. Mm. When she copies the numbers, she puts the wrong numbers in. But if you look at the process of the math, she's doing it correctly with the wrong numbers. And that was the first person who figured out that there was something not right. And it was a fellow fourth grader. And then nothing happened until I was a senior in high school when they went, oh, I think you have, it's called, you know, numeric dyslexia or dysnomia. And I'm like, well, that's what that kid in fourth grade said. I don't know what's wrong with y'all.
What took you so long?
Yeah. And then, you know, then people were like, oh, this is why you hate math. Like, yeah. Yeah. Because I know I'm doing something right, but I don't know what parts are right and what isn't. And just fuck all y'all. I don't like any of you.
No, I'm curious, Barbara, how are you with languages, like foreign languages?
I'm funny with them. That's what it is. I had 5 years of Latin. I made straight A's. My fifth year, I was translating Ovid because there was only two of us that went to fifth year in high school. And our Latin teacher was the only one in the county. And she had to have surgery and she was out for like 4 weeks. And so they sent a substitute who could do her English classes and her Spanish classes, but could not do the Latin classes. There was just no way. And so she would, you know, pass out these worksheets to these first year students and they would just look at it and be like, they had brand new textbooks, which I didn't really understand how they were teaching it. I'm like, okay, here you go. We're going to learn it how I learned it. Here's all the endings. We're going to learn them and we're going to learn them to a tune and it's going to be the way I learned it. And then we'll start translating something that's easy. And when she came back, they had started translating Julius Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic Wars because he doesn't he doesn't write like fancy. He doesn't have pretty phrases and stuff like that. He just is like, well, these barbarians smell bad and they're terrible and we're going to have to kill them this way. And, you know, or, you know, he'd finally get across the river and go crucify the lot of them. You know, it was little notes from the front, as it were. So it was easy. And she was like, who taught them this? And I was like, oh, I did. And it's way easier than those new books you got. I don't know. Do you have to teach them from that? Because it's just awful. And she's like, okay, that's weird. But I also have taken French and German and Russian. And Russian was the one I was the best at. I know Spanish, but when I try to speak it, out comes French. I don't know why that is, but Russian was what I was good at, like really good. So yeah, I'm fine with foreign languages. My husband is the exact opposite. He not only does math, he does not do foreign languages either. He's really good at English though, and really good at music and art.
Yeah, that's why I was asking. Is I have number dyslexia, but I struggle with languages.
Yeah.
I try, but it's not something I have a talent for.
Yeah.
Same with music, too, now that I think about it.
Yeah.
Music and math go together, interestingly. So I've told my husband for years that he probably is actually able to do math better than he thinks, but he disagrees with me.
Math and music and that whole thing, I know, like, fundamentally they're very tied, but practically when it comes to playing music, you don't gotta fucking know numbers. Like, you can just, like when I'm playing drums, I'm not sitting there like 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 4 whoops, you know, you just go, you play, and it just falls in time. Or like, you know, when we start songs, like the most I count to four with the drumsticks, but it's not usually even in the same tempo as the song. It's just so that we all start at the same time. I've never been good at reading music or anything, or I was one of those kids that, like, as soon as guitar tabs came out, I was like, oh, awesome, I can learn everything and never have to learn music. And like, now there's apps where you can just hold the phone up to a song and it'll tell you the chords that to play and like tell you how to play the whole song. It's really ridiculous. I didn't know that until this weekend. Yeah, I was in the studio this weekend and the engineer that we record with all the time showed me. I was like, well, that broke my brain. I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, that's a new thing and that's awesome.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. But yeah, I know math's at the base of it all, but I've never thought about it like that. Like, if I did think about it like that, I probably would have never tried to pick up a guitar or drums or anything, because I just have a knee-jerk reaction, you know? But did you all ever get, like, do you remember, and maybe it was different depending on like my experience age-wise and whatnot, but did they ever try and explain to you like how dyslexia works and like why your brain does that?
No.
No.
Yeah, no, me either. And I tried learning later on and I just confused myself more and honestly never looked into it again. So to this day, I don't know why my brain does the things it does, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. I don't know. I remember my dad trying to teach me how to tie my shoes and how to read a clock. Because, you know, this is before digital clocks. Yep. I mean, seriously, I was born in the Stone Age, y'all. We didn't have digital clocks. So I had to learn how to do it. And man, it's something about, you know, the hours turning and I couldn't do it. And left and right, tying shoes. That was terrible.
The final thing that caused my parents to realize that I had some sort of number dyslexia, and it happened years after this event happened. Barbara, you're from West Virginia, so you probably have seen these. The 84 lumber businesses.
Yeah.
We have those in Delaware too.
Oh yeah. Well, growing up, I called them 48 lumber.
Oh yeah.
So as a little kid, my parents were like, oh, that's so cute. You just can't read. And yeah, no, turns out I was just reading it backwards.
Yep.
Yeah, that's so funny. I would have never. There's a very distinct time where my oldest has a articulation delay, I guess is technically what they call it. And there was a time that was very much like me and Allie, my wife, we were like, oh, isn't this adorable how he says this thing? And then like a day later, we were like, maybe we should take him to the doctor. And like, because there's that thing where like kids just kind of start doing things on their own. And especially like Teddy was very slow to talk. And we were just like, oh, he didn't really crawl. He just went right to walk. And he's one of those kids. He'll just start talking out of nowhere and it'll just be like there. And then like he started talking and like would say things adorably. But like, you know, like I said, like very soon we went from, oh, that's adorable to, oh yeah, maybe we should see what's going on here and try and help. But it's that there's a fine line when you're working with youngins there. It's really weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, to bring it kind of back to the paranormal in a historical sense, one of the things that's interesting about the 19th century and about the world of the paranormal at that time, spiritualism was a huge thing. And spiritualism started with a hoax. It wasn't all completely a hoax, but the Fox sisters up in Hyde Park, New York, they figured out that they could make noises with their toe joints, which when I read that the first time, I was like, that's some bullshit right there. How can your toe joint be that loud and that it fills an entire hall? Well, if you put it on a hollow box, a wooden box. The wooden box acts like a resonator. And so it can be loud. I discovered this, you know, sitting on my couch, sticking my foot on the coffee table and oh, wow, it could be really loud. So that was kind of interesting. So it started with a hoax, but it then spread and then weird phenomena followed it, right? There's all of this stuff. Some of it was hoaxes. Some of it was genuinely strange phenomena. And what was interesting is that spiritualism was mostly led by women. And so there were women who were speaking publicly because of spiritualism, and they started talking about equality. Because when you died in spiritualism, everyone was equal in spirit. It didn't matter if you were a man or a woman. It didn't matter what race you were. It mattered that everyone is equal in spirit. So then what happened is they started talking about women's rights for the living. And they started talking about abolition of slavery. And that was a big thing in the Civil War. A lot of the people who were speaking about abolition were spiritualists.
Yeah.
Well, it was safe.
Yeah.
It wasn't the women talking about it. It was the dead.
Yes. They were the mouthpieces for the dead, which of course my brain is going, yeah, sure. They were just saying it because they could. And, you know, but that's, to me, that is one of those things where in our world today, we couldn't kind of cope with that in our minds. It's kind of like, people would really listen to that. So that's one of those spiritual, and mental health was another thing that was talked about by spiritualists. So fascinating.
And at this point, apparently the spirits of the Fox sisters got all upset at Barbara and disconnected her. The rest of us talked amongst ourselves for a bit, and then Barbara rejoined us.
Hi, Barbara.
Hey, you're back. Hey.
Barbara, you were talking about the spiritualists and you got cut off. And
yeah. Yeah, because they didn't like I was talking about the Fox sisters doing some hoaxing and they got mad.
We could switch to the Cottingley fairies.
Huh?
No. Let's not talk about the fairies. No.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. Yeah, I haven't given them their weekly snacks, so they'll probably be vengeful. Yeah, basically that the spiritualists became a voice of progressivism, and that is a thing that the paranormal world can kind of claim. You know, New Agers also, you know, that's that Blavatsky thing, you know, because she's all over in that. In many, many ways, they are extremely progressive, including with mental health. And then there's some that aren't as progressive. But I think it's interesting that spiritualists did have to do with good mental health treatment. And they spoke out for that. And some of them were volunteers at various mental health institutions to bring comfort and safety to the patients. So
that's fascinating. I didn't know any of that.
We're even seeing stuff like that today where I can't remember who it is. She's written several books and she's a psychiatrist, I believe. She is interacting with people who have been diagnosed with schizophrenia, multiple personality disorder, by interacting with the individual personalities. And basically asking them, okay, what do you want? Why are you here? Why are you doing what you do?
Yeah.
And by interacting with them and fulfilling those individual desires, it sometimes helps them to dissipate and leave.
Kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Makes a lot of sense. And I think you're right, Barbara, that there's such an opportunity for progressive thought and attitudes within these subjects and within these topics, because if this type of stuff doesn't promote openness, then like what will? I mean, like, I think that's such a big part of these things and what mm-hmm. can be kind of practical and beneficial, whether it's the occult or paranormal or any of these things. One of my favorite themes throughout like talking to weirdos like you all is this idea that we are consciousness connects us all, that there's something a lot bigger going on and that we are a big part mm-hmm. of a tapestry, that we're all affecting each other in certain ways. And I think the paranormal is a really interesting way to kind of find yourself to that connection point, that, you know, at the end of the day, I think we're all working towards discovering that we're connected to everybody, whether you do it through, sometimes it's that dark night of the soul, whether it's addiction or like some of the different experiences we've talked about on the show here. But those big kind of traumatic experiences, when integrated right, seem to lead to this openness and this openness to connection that really brings us all together. And sometimes you can find that through just, you know, stories of historical weirdness like you just shared. And I think that's really one of the more practical uses of all this stuff.
Well,
I feel like that's a pretty good place to end right there.
Yeah. Todd's really, really good at like summing the thing up and boom. Drop the mic, walk away. We're done.
Well, that's too kind of you. Jason, thank you for doing this, though. This was, I'm really excited we got to all hang out and talk about this. And yeah, thank you for having
absolutely.
Us and hosting and putting this all together. I know I tried to at first and dropped the ball, and I'm really glad you picked it up, because this was something that I think is really special.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to be able to do these more frequently, too.
Yeah, it worked out really, really well. Yeah.
Even if we don't record, it would be nice just to get together and talk.
Absolutely.
That would be fun.
I mean, it's very different than talking on our phones all the time.
Again, that paradox where, yeah, the phone is this like source of attention sucking. I don't want to say it's like, you know, stealing my soul half the time, but that's what it feels like. But the other part of it is this giant release for social stuff. Like most of the time I'm talking to my 6-year-old or my 2-year-old, or I'm talking to Allie, which is wonderful, but she doesn't want to hear about any of this stuff half the time anymore. So like going to those group conversations and those group chats really is meaningful to me. So for all the ills that social media has brought, it also brought this community together and allows these conversations to have. So it's like anything else. It's not all bad. It's not all good. It's right in the middle somewhere.
And how it's used, how it's applied.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Well, before we get out of here, how can people find each of you? Let's start with Todd.
You can find me at createmagicstudios.com. I have a podcast called A Create Magic Podcast, where it used to be a daily art podcast, and now it is just an interview podcast because I got burned out on doing a daily podcast after 400 and some episodes. Maybe I'll do it again at some point. But you can follow me on Instagram at ToddDE85. And yeah, the createmagicstudios.com is probably the easiest place to find all the artwork and everything.
Dazos?
I am Dazos underscore Crowsong on Instagram, and Reset 20 Studios on Etsy is where you can find whatever stuff actually makes it to market.
And Barbara.
Okay, so I am Barbara Fisher 8972 because it's a common as hell name on Instagram. And I am also on Instagram as 6 Degrees of John Keel. And I'm also 6 Degrees of John Keel.com. So those are the places you can find me.
And I am Jason. You can find me on Facebook, Patreon, Instagram, and now on Threads at Esoteric Book Club. So thanks for everyone joining us tonight. And I don't know. I don't really have a closing for this. Anyone got a catchphrase to throw out there?
Stay weird.
There you go.
There we go.
I like it.